Time now for Minnesota Reads here on Northland Morning. Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We are so pleased to welcome Sean Francis Peters as our guest this morning. Hi, Sean.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
So nice to have you along with us this morning. Your book has the most fabulous title, The Infamous Harry Hayward, A True Account of Murder and Mesmerism in Gilded Age, Minneapolis. I just like that turn of phrase. How come we've never heard about Harry Hayward?
I know, right? And that's one of the things when I first started looking into this case, I was like, oh, of course, there must be books about this man and the kind of evil stuff that he did, but there weren't. You know, it's out there. If you Google him, you can find bits and pieces, but nobody had really put the whole kind of story together, even though when this case happened, when he came to public attention in 1894 and 1895, it was national news. It wasn't just a Minnesota story. It was a national story. So newspapers in New York and Los Angeles and Chicago, like everybody in the country, had heard about it. And, you know, it just sort of happens sometimes with history. These stories fade a little bit. But that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I didn't want to write, like, the 10th book about someone. I wanted
right.
to write the first book and get the story out there.
Well, you at first, it's almost kind of a Jack the Ripper sort of thing because a young woman is murdered in Minneapolis. But, you know, to add insult to injury, like being a serial killer, you know, isn't bad enough. He is a serial seducer, a Svengali, a Machiavelli, a lunatic, a man without a soul. So tell us, who was Harry Hayward?
Yeah, it's almost hard to get your arms around him as a character because he was involved in so many different things. And those terms that you used, it's interesting. Those aren't my terms at all. Those were the terms that people used at the time to describe him. And so he wasn't someone who was just involved in the murder of one person. He was, by his own admission, involved in a series of murders over time. So that's part of it, and that's bad enough. But Harry was a womanizer. He loved meeting and seducing young women. He was a gambler. Counterfeiter, he was an arsonist, and he was purported to have mind control abilities. You use the term Svengali, and that character appeared in a novel called Trilby. It came out right before Harry became a public figure. So that term Svengali had just come into like the public conversation, and that it was said that Harry had the ability to control people with his mind, and that was this murder that the book is sort of about. That plays a part in it. It wasn't said that Harry himself had physically committed this murder, but that he had manipulated and mesmerized another man named Claus Blixt into doing it. And so for me as a writer, that kind of character, I was just amazed. Every time I found out something about him, I was like, you've got to be kidding.
Something new.
He did this. It was all really bad. And I try to find, you know, redeeming qualities in people. I don't want it to be completely one-dimensional, but it was really difficult to find anything redeeming about him at all throughout all of this. And so that's part of it for me, is that it wasn't just like one crime, one time, here's another murder, but here is this person who is really, really just a fascinating criminal study. And he was called one of the greatest criminals the world has ever seen by William Pinkerton, you know, with the Pinkerton Detective Agency, that famous man of the 19th century. So he was a prominent man and was just a bad, bad dude. There's just no other way to describe it.
Well, this was at a time also when the Victorians were starting to become interested in and dabble in spiritualism and seances. And, one of the things, of course, that Harry Houdini was also involved with was this idea of trying to make contact with the other side and that kind of thing. And some of these ideas like mind control and were kind of capturing people's imaginations. And of course, the yellow journalism that they talk about and the penny dreadfuls that were being written for people's quote-unquote entertainment. It just seems like, I don't know, Paris would be a good place for this guy, London a good place for this guy,
right?
Maybe New York, but Minnesota?
Right, and that's one of the things. So there was, you know, at the, and you mentioned yellow journalism. So journalists in the Twin Cities, there were a bunch of daily newspapers in the Twin Cities. There was a paper called the Penny Press and you know, the Tribune and some others, and they could not believe their good fortune when this crime came along because it had a little bit of everything, and it just had legs. There just kept being these revelations about Harry. So you would look at the papers, and there would be two, three, four stories every day. In 1895, the murder of Kitty Ging, that's sort of the central action of the book, that happens late in 1894. And basically, for the next year, almost every single day, papers in the Twin Cities, throughout Minnesota, throughout the Midwest, throughout the country, just feasted on this story. And it got to the point where In headlines, it wouldn't even say Harry Hayward. It would just say Harry because people knew who Harry was.
Right.
He was that notorious in 1895, and it fed in. And you're right. And the spiritualism aspect comes in a little bit later, after Harry's death. People wanna, you know, talk to him and figure out sort of what he has to say. And there are people who claim to have communicated with him after his death. So there's just it's another thing I really liked about the book is that I could talk about a lot of different interesting things about the 1890s through this story. It is pretty narrow in terms of the case, and there's a lot of dialogue and description because it's just so rich. But I also wanted to contextualize it as well to get at those things that you were talking about because they tell us more about the time. Harry's story tells us a lot about what America was like in the 1890s.
So tell me, you know, we're all armchair psychologists. We all watch, you know, crime procedurals on television, and we read crime procedurals, novels, and that sort of thing. So tell me, what do you make of Harry Hayward after having kind of dived into him? He was the kind of person, no doubt, that we didn't see a lot of, perhaps, at that time, and maybe because of the difference in the way we communicate, maybe people just didn't, maybe there were guys like him all over, but they just didn't make the papers. But what do you, how would you parse him psychologically now?
Right. So the term sociopath didn't exist in 1895. They didn't describe people that way. But there was discussion. This is another broader thing that's happening at the time and that you can use Harry's story to talk about is this, what does it mean to be insane? What does it mean to be a sociopath? And so later on, there is sort of a checklist for sociopaths, the various characteristics that they have, narcissism, lack of remorse, and if you look at the check, Harry checks off every single box that there is in terms of being a sociopath. And so I think, too, that he could exist he needed sort of an urban milieu to exist. I don't know that Harry could have done all of his scheming and his crimes and his gambling and his womanizing. I don't know if it had been 100 years earlier, it might have been a little bit more difficult for him to do. He needed a city, and Minneapolis was perfect for him because it was a city, but it was a new city. It really exploded over the previous maybe 20 years or so, and it was really coming into its own in the 1890s. So he arrived just as Minneapolis arrived and St. Paul arrived as cities. And so he, I think for a lot of people, he sort of exemplified the evils of the modern city, his greed and callousness and depravity. For lots of folks, they sort of said, aha, this is what happens in the cities. And he was that's one of the reasons why it made for such good copy in the newspapers, that you could hold him up and sort of say, this is what happens.
This is what happens,
yeah,
when you leave the farm and move to the big city.
And this is what will happen to young women, too. If they go to the big city, they can be prey to somebody like this. So it was, for a lot of people, it was just a cautionary tale in terms of what could happen at that time. What was sort of the underside of the Gilded Age?
As you were writing and researching and really getting into Harry's character, and he was becoming a three-dimensional person to you, were there echoes to you of people in this day and age? Did you say, oh, my God, that really reminds me of so-and-so, or I bet he was just like thus and such?
You know, yes and no. And, you know, the term serial killer, I think there's a dictionary definition of what is it. It's like multiple killings of in different places. And I think that's part of it. And there are certainly people, you know, Ted Bundy and so forth, in our contemporary context. He didn't really remind me of anybody directly. I felt like he was kind of a unique person in that he did a lot of bad and manipulative things in a way that was very singular. And he was a creature of his time. I do think that he could exist today. I think that there you could absolutely be this sort of sociopathic type of person in a contemporary context as well. So but for me, he really spoke to that time and that place, and that's what. And I really didn't try to. I didn't necessarily try to compare him to other people, even in my head as I was writing, because I didn't want it to fall into a pattern. I didn't want to say, he's a type of person.
Right.
You know this type of
right.
person. I wanted to say he's a different
right.
type of person. And also, the book itself and the story itself, you know, these books are often written. There definitely is a true crime template, and there's a sort of murder mystery template. And this book isn't really like that. It's pretty clear from the beginning how the murder, who did it, how it happened. And it's more of a study of who is this person who was behind this murder, and how could he have been such a manipulative, evil person?
And, of course, now he'd be all over Twitter, and that would be the end of it. But, maybe not.
Right. No, I did think about that in terms of, social media and the way the story and the, you know, if you watch, Making a Murderer or other, shows on Netflix, and, how this would unspool today, there would, on Reddit or something online, there would be lots of theories and there would be lots of rumors. There are lots of rumors still today about Harry. If you look online, I heard, and that was one of the challenges in writing the book, actually, is just lots of, there's this rumor that that the Masons in Minneapolis sort of stole his body and resurrected him later. There's all sorts of tall tales about him. And if this had happened today, I can't even imagine. This era of yellow journalism, it was great for then, but for today it would be even better. There would be, everything from, internet theorizing to probably like a made-for-TV movie. It's that.
And conspiracy, like you say, conspiracy theories, and of course, and he'd be no doubt getting swamped with letters in jail.
And he was, and that did happen to him. He conducted this kind of lurid romance with a young woman like while he was in jail, and those letters came out much later, and they just sort of confirmed for everybody again just how manipulative and devious and horrible he was as a person. And so that's what made it. It was a challenging story to tell in a way, because it was sort of hard to tell what was true and what wasn't. And that's a challenge you face anytime you're writing nonfiction. And he actually he penned a confession. He dictated a confession towards the end of his life, and that was helpful because it seemed like if you believe that the confession is authentic and reliable, as I do, that helped separate some of the truth from fact, lots of every murder that happened in every murder of a young woman in Minnesota, basically, he was accused of having done.
Right.
He helped us set the record straight in terms of what he had done and what he hadn't done. And that was helpful for me, too, as you try to kind of triangulate with source materials and, you know, what can I rely on? What is what seems a little bit far-fetched? But some of the things that seemed really far-fetched to me actually turned out to be true, which made it an interesting story. I didn't, you know, one of the reasons I really love this book is that it was fun and fascinating to write, and I think that comes through in the book. It's an interesting and engrossing book. I'm an academic historian by training, but I'm also a journalist, and I wanted it to be a book that people could pick up and read and really get into, and it wouldn't be kind of a chore to read some professor type telling a dry history. That would be a disservice to the story. I just sort of try to get out of the way and let the story tell itself, because it's such an amazing story.
Well, it's a wonderful read to just lose yourself in, you know, in a character that is just unashamedly, unapologetically bad from the get-go. And Sean, thank you so very much for joining us this morning. What a treat to have you on the line with us.
Well, it was wonderful speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Sean Francis Peters has written a marvelous, marvelous read. It's called The Infamous Harry Hayward, A True Account of Murder and Mesmerism in Gilded Age Minneapolis. Minnesota Reads on Northland Morning is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.